Did you take his name and address? Can you be good without God? Of course, if you ask anybody on the outside, the answer is obviously yes. Everybody knows there are good religious people and not so good religious people, and there are good non-religious people and not so good non-religious people. Open and shut. I don't think it's so simple. I think, first of all, that the question divides in two. Because good divides in two. You can talk about good or bad actions, and you can talk about good or bad agents, people. These are two separate concepts. In fact, a good person acting out of good character can do a bad action, and a bad person acting out of bad character can do a good action. Here, Peter is drowning in the river. George jumps in, and at a considerable risk to his life, pulls Peter to the shore to safety, turns him over, takes his wallet out of his back pocket, and runs. All George wants is Peter's wallet. It's just very difficult to fish out somebody's wallet while he's drowning. If he could have let down a hook and just sort of, you know, pulled it out of his back pocket, he would have let him drown. It's just not practical. So here he saved his life, which is certainly a good action, as a bad person acting on bad motives with bad character. On the other hand, Peter is stopped by the side of the road. His car is broken down. George, who knows a little bit about cars, a little bit, stops and offers to help, opens up the hood, reconnects a few wires. Does Peter try it now? Peter turns the ignition, the car goes, boom! Big puff of smoke. Peter says, oh gosh, I'm awful sorry. I mean, George says, we're awful sorry. Now, George is a good person, acting out of good motives, and he blew up Peter's car. So there are good and bad actions, and good and bad agents. So the question really divides in two. Can your actions be good without God? One question. And can you have good character without God? Those are two different questions. Let's do them one at a time. Let's start with actions. I want to illustrate for you something about actions in more details. Same point I made before, really, but I'll make it in more detail. Let's imagine a family that goes through the Holocaust. Father, mother, and son. They get separated. The parents think the son has died. The son thinks the parents have died. They don't search for each other. All three make it to the United States. The son ends up in Los Angeles, opens a business, does very well, buys a house in Beverly Hills, making a lot of money, and is very charitable. Every month, he sets aside a certain amount of money to his charity account. Every month, he exhausts the account. His reputation for being a charitable person. Parents come to America, but because they're older, They're not trainable, and they become beggars. They travel the country begging. And they end up in Los Angeles. They're going door to door in Beverly Hills. And they knock on their own son's door. Goes to the door, can I help you? And they say, we're looking for charity. 25 years have gone by. The parents don't recognize the child. The child doesn't recognize the parents. And the child says, the son says, today is July 29th. The July allotment has been used up. Come back on August 5th, and that's when the new money will be in. I'll be happy to help you. I finish up my allotment every month. This month it happens to be finished. The parents say, but on August 1st, we have a ride to San Francisco. We can't afford to pass up a free ride. He says, well, look, I'd love to help you, but I can guarantee you that starting August 5th, there'll be a lot of people here, and I will help them. If you're here, I would help you. And if you're not here, so I'll help other people. And he turns them away. Now, isn't that tragic? Of course, not that the son is an evil person. He's a wonderful person. There's no critique of his moral character, but isn't the action tragic? Imagine, 5 years later, the parents are killed in an automobile crash. And some reporter discovers that they're Holocaust survivors and became beggars, and he writes up a whole article and does a lot of background. And the son reads the article in the newspaper, and he realizes that those were his parents. And he sees pictures of them. And he realizes that his own parents came to his own door, and he didn't help them. Now, there's no point in his feeling guilty. He didn't do anything bad. He didn't intend anything bad. He wasn't vicious or cruel or insensitive or hard-hearted or... But he turned away his own parents. It's a terrible thing to have done. Even though it's done in ignorance, it is a terrible thing to have done. Another example. There was a time, not too long ago, when if a person had a fever, he would go to a doctor and get bled. In America, the barber poles have that red stripe. That's because the red stripe means we bleed you here. That's one of the things barbers did. Bleed people. We don't do that anymore. Can you guess why? Because it's not good for your health, actually. Now imagine a doctor who did this all his life because that's what the best medical opinion said. And on his deathbed, the new information comes in that really hurts people. How is that doctor going to feel? Of course, he's not vicious. He did the best he could. But the best he could was hurting people. And he, being a person committed to improving people's health, is going to feel terrible about it. This shows you that even if you're a good person, your ignorance can cause you to do terrible actions. Another example, and then I'm going to draw the analogy. You're tramping through the forest, and you come across a clearing in which there are apple trees. And they're laden with ripe apples in the middle of the forest. You say, wow, look at that. That's terrific. And you take out a couple of apples and you eat them, and then you take a bag and you fill it up with some apples. You're about to walk off when somebody comes running out of the forest and says, thief, thief, stop! What are you doing? You're stealing my apples! You say to him, what are you, nuts? I'm tramping through the forest. You know, this is open forest. This doesn't belong to anybody. These apple trees just happen to be here. He says, no, you're a thief! There's a fence around my whole property. There's no trespass signs around the whole property, and you're a thief! He says, you're nuts. Look, I'll show you how I got here. He takes the guy back, the path that he came, come to a certain point, and the guy says, oh my gosh, look at that. Someone has removed a section of the fence. And he takes the traveler, and he says, walk with me 50 yards this way. They walk 50 yards, and indeed, there starts a fence with no trespassing signs. and you walk 50 yards this way, and this says another fence with no trespassing sign. And there are clear signs that the thing's been ripped out. Okay. Now, what is the traveler going to do? How's he going to feel? What's he going to say? And what's he going to do? I think, first of all, he's going to apologize. I'm awfully sorry. I didn't mean to eat your apples. I didn't know that your apples. You see, I came in and there was no fence there. But it's true, I ate your apples. And I'm willing to pay for them. Since they weren't my apples. They were your apples. They weren't hefker, as we say. They weren't ownerless. They weren't abandoned. And I did eat your apples, and I'm prepared to pay for them because unwittingly, unknowingly, I took your property. Here the person is saying, I know that what I did was wrong. I'm not a vicious person, but what I did was objectively wrong. I took somebody else's property without his permission. And therefore, I should pay for it, and I'm prepared to pay for it. These are examples of how a person's actions can go wrong. His actions are objectively wrong, even though he's not vicious, because of ignorance. Now, let's imagine for a moment that there is a God. That God created the universe and creates, presents the universe, maintains its existence. Let's see how things look. Well, if God creates the universe out of nothing, it's fair, I think, to say that he owns it. Ownership is one of these debated topics, and it has certain limits, may be set. But if God creates a table out of nothing, that's a clear case of ownership. I won't pass judgment now on whether he can own us. That's a very strong proposition. If you think God can own people, then that has very far-reaching consequences. But there are people who will deny that. People will say that people can't be owned in principle. So let's leave people out. But the mountains and the valleys, the rivers and the oceans, and the trees and the flowers and the grasses, the grains and the butterflies and the mosquitoes and the whippoorwills and the orangutans and those lovely porpoises discussing Shakespeare underwater, and all of it belongs to God. No, if it belongs to him, then he has certain rights. He has certain rights as to how it should be used. Now, God says to Jews, don't eat pigs. Translation, God says, they're my pigs. They're my pigs. I own them. And I don't give you permission to eat them. You can use them. You can play football with the pigskin, okay? But you can't eat them. Now, a Jew, in his ignorance, not knowing that God created the universe, or not knowing that God prohibited Jews from eating pigs, when he eats pork chops, he is objectively a thief. His actions are objectively wrong. Because he's taking the owner's property without permission. In exactly the same way that the traveler through the forest took the apples in ignorance, is objectively a thief. So if there is a God, and he creates the universe, he therefore owns it, and he set down rules for how it should be used, a person who blithely disregards this and says, I'm a good person because I don't cheat on my taxes or because I help my neighbors, is making a mistake, because many of his actions can be objectively wrong actions. Similarly, let's say that the creator of the universe, who gives each one of us life, health, energy, intelligence, resources, gives, present tense, moment by moment, says, if you are a Jewish male, I want a half hour in the morning with leather boxes and leather straps. That's what I want. I'm telling you, that's what I want from you. Now, shouldn't a person make a calculation and say, let's see, he's giving me my life, my health, my energy, my intelligence, all my resources, and he wants a half hour a day with leather boxes. Do I owe him that much? Is it within the bounds of the gratitude for what I'm receiving? Now, of course, if you're an American, you could have a doubt about this. Don't tell me what to do. Get off my back. You know, nobody gives me orders. I do as I please, and all the rest of that, Americans can't. But if you find an American in a sober moment, try to find him in a sober moment, I think you'll have to agree that life, health, intelligence, energy, and resources are worth the half hour of the morning. Suppose God put it in reverse. If you don't give me the half hour in the morning, I'll take them away. Would he have any hesitation in paying? I don't think so. Which means that it's clearly worth it. So a person who blithely disregards the fact that there's a creator of the universe and says, I pay my taxes, I'm good to my neighbors, I'm nice to my kids, and therefore I'm okay, can be performing actions that are objectively wrong in ignorance, and then he's really not okay. His actions, many of them will be objectively wrong actions. And when he will discover the truth in this world or later, and realize how many of his actions were objectively wrong, he will feel the same sense of crushing regret that the doctor felt when he discovered that he was injuring people's health. Or the son felt when he didn't help out his parents. Or the traveler in the forest felt when he realized that he was taking somebody else's apples. So I think it is not possible for a person's actions, certainly not all of them, to be good without God. Assuming there is a God, the person who blithely disregards that and says, I don't need God, and I don't need religion, I'm a good person anyway, is making a terrible mistake. Because if there is a God, then he has to take account of it in calculating what actions are good, what actions he should perform. Now, these reflections have some further consequences. There are certain movements, certain groups, who teach that the commandments should be divided into two categories. There are moral commandments and ritual commandments. I know this from the inside because that's how I grew up. What's the idea? Well, pursuing justice, giving charity, not stealing, not injuring people, those are moral commandments. Keeping Shabbos, keeping kashrus, making sure there's no linen and wool in your clothing, those are ritual commandments. Now, the difference is this. The moral commandments are really important because if you break a moral commandment, then you're immoral. And that's not good. Whereas if you break a ritual commandment, then I guess you're not a ritual, which is not really so terribly important. The ritual commandments are throwaways. Sometimes they tell you, yeah, if you keep the ritual commandments, that will develop your self-control and your focus so that when you have to make a moral decision, you'll have stronger character to make it correct. Sort of indirect psychological strengthening. But this misses the point entirely. Because if there is a God who commanded these things, then we have a moral obligation to keep all the commandments. There's no such thing as a non-moral commandment. Because we have a moral obligation to God. What this distinction forgets or purposely disregards is the fact that we have a moral relationship with God. A person who says, I'm good to my parents and I'm good to my spouse, and I'm good to my friends and my neighbors, and I'm good to my children, I live up to all my citizenship responsibilities, has not yet proved that he's good. What about his responsibilities to God? Those are moral responsibilities, just like the rest of them. And if he ignores those, then in that area his actions are going to be morally inappropriate actions.
if he does everything right, then I'll manage him. He does everything right for God.
Now, just turn it around. If he isn't doing right for God, then he automatically isn't doing everything right.
Right, but if he does everything right, like you said, where his family, and society, and automatically he does everything right for God.
Why? Why does that follow? Why does that follow? God says keep Shabbos. What way can he express that by what he does to his parents and his children and his neighbors? He can be very nice to them and still not live up to keeping Shabbos.
He's a boy. He's talking about a boy.
Then he can not eat flesh from a living animal. Flesh has been taken from a living animal. Maybe oysters on the half shell, which are swallowed live, is not appropriate for a goy. He won't know that. No, it isn't. It isn't possible if you don't take it into account, because it's a source of moral obligation that he's not taking into account. This means that all of the commandments are morally binding. Now, that's actions. Let's now talk a little bit about... Yeah.
What about doing actions?
Doing actions because of fear.
Yeah.
Yes. We being afraid of punishment.
Yeah.
So we're talking now about actions. And if the action is done out of fear, the action is still right. People who don't speak, push ahead, they're afraid of being caught by the police force, are obeying the speed limit. They're not very exalted. They're not people who show great moral sensitivity. By the level of actions, the actions are correct. Which is not the case for people who eat pork chops, in ignorance of God's prohibition. The action is incorrect. I'm talking now just about the level of action. Something's not registering here.
Yeah. You see, I think what I'm trying to say is you're doing the action because you're afraid of punishment from above, not being a person in a pork chop is wonderful, great, but when he starts taking on these moral obligations, then maybe he's doing it out of fear, not out of anything else.
Okay. What difference does that make? Does it mean his actions are not right actions?
No.
So why should I worry about his motivation at this point in the discussion? What difference does it make while he's doing it?
Yes.
When we talk about moral character, that's where it'll make a difference. But up to here, I don't see if it makes any difference.
Yeah. My understanding of Judaism is such that we have an insight into God's judgment. We have a principle called shogeg, and an action is only appropriate in a certain context, and only judged a certain way in a certain context. So, in other words, it's not objectively wrong for Jesus to eat pork, necessarily, unless he makes a free will decision to do that. And that's shown by what punishment he will receive.
Adarabah. The truth is the exact opposite. The punishment is proportioned to the responsibility of the agent for the action. The less he knows, the less he appreciates, the less training he's had, the less responsible he is for the action. Doesn't make the action objectively right. It means he's less responsible for doing the wrong thing. So of course it's wrong.
It's the best one to learn.
Shogeg is only a principle of how responsible you are for doing the wrong thing. It only, the question of shogeg only arises when what you did was wrong. Now we want to know. I think it's appropriate for me to finish discussion with him.
I
paused didn't come at the beginning of your remarks. Shogeg is a principle of responsibility for the action performed. The reason the question of shogeg comes up is because the action is a wrong action, and we want to know what kind of punishment is appropriate for a person who performed an action like that. If it's shogeg, it means he's less punishable because he has less responsibility for the action. It doesn't make the action less wrong. It means he's less responsible for the wrong thing that happened.
You can just make it indifferent, the action. Not necessarily wrong.
Of course not. Of course not. Let's imagine that a person takes milk and meat and cooks it together. Now, if he's totally ignorant of what he's doing, does that mean that other people can eat the milk and meat? No, he cooked milk and meat in violation of the Torah's prohibition of cooking milk and meat. Just that he might not be punishable for that wrong thing that he did. Those doctors who didn't know that they were injuring people's health, they still were injuring people's health. Why should they feel regret if, since they are blameless, they didn't do anything wrong. But they do feel regret, because they clearly did something wrong. Only, because they were ignorant, they're not culpable for it.
So what would the negative effect be of a person not following the Torah, though, if they're not aware of the Torah?
What's the negative effect of a child turning away his parents, who wants his help, and he turns them away because he doesn't know who they are? The negative effect is that he turned away his own parents. That's tragic in and of itself. Correct. That means he's not vicious. Doesn't mean what he did was okay. Correct. And therefore, it means that his moral character is fine, but what he did was a tragedy. Doesn't take away the tragedy that he didn't know who it was. It just means that you don't punish him, but you point out to him that, you know, and he will feel terrible about it. Right? Any natural human being knows if he's injured somebody else, especially somebody else to whom he owes something like a child owes to his parents, is going to feel terrible for having done it, even if he's not vicious about it. Yeah.
Based on what we said so far, how do we define a good person in the event of a quote-unquote good person repeatedly doing bad acts?
Based on what we said so far, there's no definition whatsoever. I haven't said anything yet about what it takes to be a good person. I haven't just addressed that. I've just been talking about good and bad actions.
So to get this punishment, it's best to stay even.
That's true. That's true. You avoid punishment that way, and you avoid reward that way, and you avoid accomplishing anything that way. That's true. That's true. If you never drive a car, you'll never get a speeding ticket. You'll never get anywhere. That's quite true. If you never drive a train, so you'll never cause an accident, and you'll never move people from one place to another. Every accomplishment carries with it dangers. No question about it. The only way to protect yourself from dangers is to accomplish nothing. By the way, the Sabbat Rosh Hashanah de Bracha made a point, there's a verse, Ein Adam Tzadik Ba'aretz Asheya Astov L'Yechta. There's no man righteous in the earth who does good and does not fail. So the Sabbath Rav asks, why does it say does good? We're describing him as a tzaddik. Doesn't a tzaddik automatically do good? That's what a tzaddik is. So why does it say there's no person who's a tzaddik who does good who will not fail? The Sabbath Rav says, a person could be a tzaddik by being very conservative. Just hiding himself away and not involving himself too much with what's going on in the world, so he avoids opportunities to fail. That might be possible. If you take away the atzatov, if you take away this qualification that he's doing good, then maybe he can protect himself. But if he's a tzaddik who's dedicated himself to do something good, there will be failures. There will automatically be failures. But that's the price of doing something good. Talmud says there are four people on record who died not through their own failures, but because of the sin of Adam. Four people. Who are they? Binyamin, Benjamin, Jacob's the youngest son. Amram, Moses' father. Yishai, David's father. And one of David's sons named Kalev. That's not the top 10. It's probably not the top 20. You know, that's not the hit parade of Jewish stardom. Not Abraham, not Isaac, not Jacob, not Joseph, not Judah, not Levi, not Moses, not Aaron, not Miriam, not David, not Shlomo, not Deborah, not Shmuel, not... Right? Because they were relatively conservative. They were relatively limited. Those people who made it to the top undertook such projects of good that, indeed, they made mistakes. At any rate, that's what I want to say about actions. Now let's talk a little bit about good moral character. Good moral character goes beyond the actions that you perform. It includes why you perform them. George is on his way to Beijing. Now, George has sticky fingers, and he steals. And I tell George, listen, George, in Beijing, there are hidden cameras everywhere, plainclothes policemen everywhere, and if they catch you stealing, they chop off your hand. So I recommend that in Beijing, you just keep it clean. He listens to me. He believes me. Goes to Beijing, spends 2 years there, clean as a whistle, dies there. And had George become righteous? Virtuous? No, he's just scared. This is your problem. He's just scared. To be righteous means to do the right thing? Because it's right. To be virtuous means to do the good thing because it's good. Not for other reasons. Now, the second part of the question will be, can a person be a good person? Have good motivation? Act out of moral values? If the person is not religious. Here, I think the answer is a little grayer. The answer is, I think it's possible, but it's much harder, and the rate of success is much lower. That's what I want to show you. Let's start with a question of principle. Is it possible to train people in moral character? To educate people in moral character? To influence them as they grow and as they are adults? To have better moral character? Or is it not? Now, here is where people don't think at all. They just play politics. If I say this, then what's going to follow? And how am I to get trapped in that? And so on and so on. So I'll play politics also. I'll trap all the liberals. Here's the trap. What do you say about people who grow up to be criminals? Don't you say that it was their poor environment that led them to develop that kind of character? An overbearing father, or poverty, or overcrowding in the inner city, or poor schools, or poor inspiration and examples. Isn't that your explanation for how people develop criminal character? Especially if you're a liberal. Don't get me wrong. I'm not recommending being a liberal. But that's the standard excuse. The standard excuse is, what do you expect from them? Look how they grew up. Look at the conditions that they had. Look what they had to suffer with. Look what they had to contend with. Right. Let's suppose that's true. Well, then the flip side ought to be true also. That a person grows up in a more supportive environment, a more encouraging environment, more dedicated and focused environment, should develop better moral character. Couldn't be that the environment can only hurt and can't help. That couldn't be, because if you remove the hurt, at least that will leave you with an environment which won't hurt you so much, so you'll come out better. So if we accept the proposition that the environment can help in developing moral character, then we ought to ask, what cultures, what societies invest in an environment that develops good moral character? And what societies do not so invest? Let's see. Let's take standard American secular culture. When I was living in Baltimore many years ago, in the summers, there's a fairground, and every ethnic group came to take over the fairgrounds for a week. There was a Jewish fair also. So we in the Jewish community went down in strength to talk to the missionaries who came to talk to Jews to convert them to Christianity. So we talked to them to keep them distracted so they wouldn't talk to Jews who might listen. So it's quite sporty. I met one fellow there, not a missionary. Jewish fellow, not religious, and he exuded such self-satisfaction that it really irritated me. You could imagine me being irritated about that. So I said to him, are you perfect? And he said, me? Perfect? Of course not. I have faults like everybody else. So I said, what are you doing to improve yourself? What are you doing to rid yourself of your faults? He thought for a minute and he said, nothing. I said, well, you know that you have certain faults and you're not doing anything to rid yourself of them. I said, what about your business? If you found that your business was losing money, or the product was coming out inferior, or somebody wasn't doing their job, wouldn't you do something to improve it? Hire an efficiency expert or check on the people's productivity and so forth and so on? Sure, he said. So I said, well, why aren't you doing something about your own faults? He said, Rabbi, I eat well. I sleep well. I accept myself as I am, with my faults. That really irked me. So I said to him, you have children? Yeah. 12-year-old son. I said, suppose the police come home with your 12-year-old son, and they said they caught him in the local department store stealing. And when you confront him, your son says, "Yes, Dad, it's true. I do steal from the department store. But don't worry, I eat well. I sleep well. I accept myself." I'm like, "What would you say?" At that point, he remembered the very pressing appointment and broke off the conversation. Go into the local bookstore. Look at all of the designations of topics. Find one, not a topic, one book on moral self-improvement. One. You won't find even one. You go to the self-help section. Self-help is dedicated to saving your marriage, improving your strategy at chess, or improving your ability to compete at tennis, or improving your ability to out-compete your other executives in your firm, or things that have the right kind of bottom line. To increase your tranquility, which will lower your high blood pressure, things like that. But a book on how to become a better person, more virtuous person? I fly a lot. Sometimes I look at the magazines that they hand out. I see there are advertisements for executive seminars. I look for the topics. What kinds of things do you teach in executive seminars? And I see a topic, business ethics. I think to myself, what country am I in? Business ethics? This can't be America. You know, maybe it's Zululand. I don't know. Whoever they do business. But then look at the bottom. If you have good business ethics, your employees will be more loyal, so you won't have to retrain new employees, and your customers will be more loyal, and your suppliers will be more loyal, and you'll make more profit. Oh, that's right. I'm in the right country. Right? Ethics for the sake of more profit. Correct. Let's finish the point. I'll be glad to take questions. American schooling. Democratic theory of schooling is that since the country doesn't have an official religion and doesn't have a state-sponsored value system, so the schools must not teach any ethical system and no religion. Of course, that's not strictly true. They do very sharply teach all of the values that are necessary for being good students. That they do. Don't copy from each other's papers, otherwise we'll punish you. Don't disturb the class or we'll punish you. But beyond that, no values are meant to be taught. You know what the result is. The influence of school is that there are no other values. Because with respect to the rest of life, everything goes. Eventually, he erodes even those values. Parents are so confused by the variety of different lifestyles and the crippling feeling that I can't take a stand against anything that's different from me because otherwise I'm showing I'm intolerant, can't teach values to their children either. The bottom line is that there is no effective teaching of values, there's no effective portrayal of values. The society as a whole doesn't go on record in favor of more than the minimum number of values that are necessary to keep the society going. Yes, when there's a war, it's important to be a good soldier. Correct. Otherwise, the country will be conquered. Society will go down the drain. But beyond that, it's an open door. If that's the case, we should expect that the development of good moral character will be relatively rare. It can happen. You can have people who are gifted or people who are naturally inspired. People who read the right literature. But it's going to be relatively rare. Contrast that with a society where developing moral character is a, if not the, prime value. We're talking, in our case, about a society where three times a day a person thinks, at least for a moment, what have I done wrong and what can I do to improve? And there are major holidays of the year, 10 days from Rosh Hashanah through Yom Kippur. There are the fast days where we acknowledge that our moral and spiritual failings brought disaster upon the nation. And there are the stories, the endless stories of our heroes who distinguished themselves in great moral achievement. The biographies and the collections of stories from the Midrash and from the Talmud. This is what we teach our children. And when our children show signs of this kind of feeling, We're thrilled that we encourage it. I have a 5-year-old grandchild. She went to the store for her mother. It was right over here in Elia Cohen. And someone saw her there, standing in front of the bags that which you put your groceries, and sort of wondering what she was doing. So the person asked her, "What's the matter? Do you need help?" She said, "Well, I noticed that there are only a few big bags left. Now, I have a few things to take over. If I use a big bag, there won't be big bags for other people to take. So I'm thinking maybe I should take mine in 2 or 3 little bags, and that way I'll leave the big bags behind." 5 years old. This is what she's thinking about 5 years old. She's not thinking, "Where can I get another shekel to get another lollipop from?" She's thinking about somebody else who will use the bags. Right? Now that's natural for us. That's natural for us. One of our children, when she was 8, used to give them allowance, some money. We noticed that she didn't buy what all the other kids bought. We found out that an 8-year-old, she was putting aside a certain amount of it for a certain charity that she wanted to support. We didn't tell her to do that. We didn't tell her that she had to do that. But she grew up in a house and a school and friends and a literature and a culture in which this sort of thing is regarded as normal, the normal thing to do. Now, you go to any neighborhood that has a neighborhood telephone book. You open it up at the beginning, and there is the list of the Gamachim, the free loan societies. You should really take out such a list and look at it. It's really astonishing. People stockpile items for free use. Power tools. Furniture and artificial flowers for celebrations. Wedding gowns. Do you know how much a wedding gown can cost? $1,000. $1,500. Here you have people who stockpile these wedding gowns. You take them, you use them, you dry clean them, and bring them back. It costs you $25. Not only for the bride, but for the sisters of the bride and all the rest of them and the little kids who have to come down scattering petals or whatever they do. Right? There are dresses for all of them for the charge of dry cleaning. You have advice. Lawyers who will give advice. Doctors who will give advice. Accountants who will give free advice. There are gamachim of medicines. What happens at 3 in the morning when a person has a medical emergency and needs a medicine? Usually in a city like Jerusalem, maybe 1 or 2 pharmacies open. So you got to take a taxi there, and come back and take half an hour, 3/4 of an hour. Someone 2 or 3 buildings away has a stock. They come in with a doctor's prescription showing that you need that medicine. They'll give it to you. And then later you'll replace it. There are gamachim for lost children. What happens if a child is lost on Shabbos? Where do you go to look for him? Can't pick up the telephone and call people. So there are certain families who stockpile lost children. And if you, God forbid, have lost a child, you go to those families and that's where you find your children. Can you imagine those families? Every Shabbos they have these kids crying and screaming and, you know, what difference does it make? They're holding them safe so the parents will be able to find them. There are pacifier gamachs. What happens if your baby loses the pacifier in Shabbos? You can have a screaming shout. No, there's a neighbor with pacifiers. There are a gamach for chickpeas. Why chickpeas, you ask? Because Friday night, if a son is born to the family, Friday night they're supposed to make a celebration and invite all the neighbors, and you have to have cooked chickpeas. What happens if the baby is born an hour and a half before Shabbos? Who's going to make chickpeas? Don't worry, there's a neighbor who has a stockpile, and he gives them to you, and you give them back to him. I mean, now, if you have, let's say, 2,000 families, you'll have 200 of them who will provide some free service or other to the public. Because that's how a Jewish community works. You go away for a weekend, for Shabbos, you tell your neighbors, "I'm going away. If you need the apartment, tell me, and I'll leave you the keys. You know, if you have somebody coming in to visit you." When I became frum, and I told certain people that we did this, they thought we were nuts. They said, "Either they'll rob you blind, or they'll destroy your apartment." What do you mean you give your apartment to strangers? Yeah, that's right. They can't imagine. Clothes. No family wears clothes and throws them out when the kids are too large. They give them over to other families. Clothes are worn and worn and worn until they really wear out. Now, this is a level of moral performance which is markedly superior to the level of moral performance in the surrounding secular culture. I don't say there aren't morally outstanding secular people, and I don't say that there aren't religious people who are moral failures. That's certainly true. But it is pointless to raise that fact. It's pointless. Because for any general rule, it's possible to find exceptions. On those grounds, you should never use any drug. Because every drug has failures. There are people who are allergic to penicillin, and it causes a very severe reaction. That's not a reason to stop using penicillin. Penicillin is a very beneficial drug with a few failures, correct? Here, this system regularly produces a much higher level of moral performance. Much higher. Not perfect, but much higher. But it's not a surprise. Because if you agree that environment, education, training, inspiration can have effect on the development of moral character, and here you have a culture that invests in it, you should expect the moral performance to be higher. And therefore, as I say, the answer to the second question is, can there be a morally good character? Be a morally good person without God? The answer is, you can, but it's much harder and much rarer. Yeah.
I agree with you that like the basic structure and generally the outcome is like of a higher moral standard. But like, what do you think the reasons for like there seem to be basic like almost uniform lapses in like basic manners among like the Haredi or Hasidic community? Like for example, I go Friday night to the hotel every Shabbos, and it seems that there's not a single person there doesn't hesitate to bump into me and not say excuse me when I go to my buddy and Dave is in Lakewood. When I go there, I'm dressed a little different, and every single person points and talks about me and doesn't hesitate to, you know, it doesn't matter that I'm looking at them, and that kind of thing I don't think happens in the secular community.
Well, as far as bumping into people is concerned, it definitely does happen. You're now coming across a cultural difference, and it depends on what culture you happen to be in. If you'll be in Italy, you'll find that it's definitely that way. Mediterranean cultures tend to be that way. Go to a British soccer game and see how you're treated there, in Great Britain, of all places. See whether they bump into you and don't say they're sorry and so on and so on. It's a matter of a cultural norm. After all, if it really were such a nasty thing to do, how come they do it to each other? And how come nobody protests? How come nobody says, hey, leave me alone? Because culturally, that's accepted. I find this very interesting. People who, given their chosen politics, I'm not speaking about you now, but people who, given their chosen politics, will plead for understanding of the difference of different cultures. When they come in contact with this culture, all of a sudden they become very absolutist and say, these things are objectively wrong. When it really is just a matter of a different culture. Competing for someone's attention in a store. The way it's done here, you would never do it in America. You see, a person's helping you, someone else will come up and ask him a question. In America, you would never do that. You would wait, and you would wait your turn, even if you only had to ask a question. But here, the culture allows it. So each person knows that if somebody else asks a question, it's acceptable. And if he needs to ask a question, he'll ask a question also. You, being an American, feel you're being cheated on. But that's just a difference in culture. Now, people who make fun of those who are different from them, try dressing as a chassid in the secular area and see what the kids will do and see how the parents will talk and see the kind of attention. Only the range of styles that you engage in are the range of styles that they regard as appropriate. The minute you take a style that they don't regard as appropriate, you get exactly the same reaction.
I don't see that being true. Like, when I see, like, where I live, there's basically no, like, religious community. And, like, if my Bobby and Diddy come and visit, or there's a Chabad rabbi, like, that my family's close to, when he goes around and he's in a, like, almost 100% secular area, people aren't pointing at him. But I when I go into a religious area and I'm not dressed the same, every single person turns and looks, and they don't feel the need to hide. Like, and I think even when, like, in a secular community, like, I agree, they do give a second glance. But I think that there's more of, like, a tendency to kind of hide it.
I don't think you're right at all. I don't think you're right factually. That's simply not right factually. I'll tell you to try an experiment. wear a cap instead of wearing a yarmulke and walk into Mei HaShoarim and see how many people will turn around and look at you. I guarantee you that not one in ten will look at you. Why? Because lots of people like you go there, and therefore they regard it as a normal thing. And they don't. But when it's a place where people don't go, where it's very, very rare, the same thing will happen. A Yochabad rabbi is a resident there, so they know him. He's accepted there. But try somebody going on with a strimal. He doesn't wear a strimal. Let somebody go there with a strimal. They get exactly the same stares. Indeed, when I put on a strimal in Baltimore, it was a difficulty walking down the street because I almost caught some accidents. Driving along, and they were turning around because it was shocking. I'm not blaming anybody. It is shocking. If it's really different, and for you it's really bizarre, it's going to attract attention. Quite right. So I don't see that that's really different. If you think that everyone is staring at you, I think you have a certain hypersensitivity.
I mean, I watch people pointing and talking about me. That just doesn't happen.
Well, it will happen if you were a strangle in a secular area. There, you might even get thrown stones at you. Yeah. In this country.
One thing that I thought was the environment.
Yeah.
What about the guilt? What about guilt?
What about guilt?
Guilt, as in, we were talking about. Reward and punishment, feeling bad about what you've done.
I think guilt is a good thing. Are we on the same? Are we on the same wavelength? I'm not quite sure where your remark fits into what I was saying.
Like with the son.
Yes.
With the son in paradise.
Ah.
He's feeling bad. He's feeling guilty.
No, I don't think that's right. I think this is a tricky point here. There's a tricky point here. Imagine two cases. Two people are walking together.
Right.
And there's a flower pot sitting on a ledge. And one, through not looking where he's going, knocks the flower pot off and falls on his friend. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do that. I'm terribly sorry, right? Now, imagine that someone two stories up knocks off a flower pot and hits your friend. You might also say, oh, that's God, I'm so sorry that happened to you.
Yeah.
That's not expressing guilt.
Yeah.
You can be sorry that something happened, even without expressing guilt. If you hear somebody fell down and hurt himself, oh, I'm so sorry. That's not guilt. That's just empathy.
Yeah.
The word sorry doesn't mean necessarily that I'm guilty. So I don't think it's right that I mean, if he really feels guilty, then maybe he's got a problem.
Maybe he's got
an emotional problem.
The guy who lets him eat pork chops, that he realizes he shouldn't be doing that anyway.
That's something else. We haven't spoken about that. I was talking about cases where the person performed the wrong action through ignorance.
Okay.
If he does it knowing that it's wrong, then indeed he will feel guilty. And there are people like that who don't make the effort to change and to improve their actions, but they do feel guilty. They should feel guilty. It's healthy to feel guilty under those conditions. A person who doesn't feel guilty under those conditions has a moral, psychological failure.
And
yeah. But yeah.
Also, another question is with the environment. What isn't it an intrinsic belief that one should do? One should be a moral person.
Should be a
moral person, not.
You're talking about in the secular world?
Yeah.
Well, you come from a different country, my friend. And let me tell you, when you come to the United States of America, you will discover 270 million people, of whom a large proportion have different feeling about this. About 5 years ago, I was reading a paper in the States. There was a debating team in Chicago, high school debating team. It was an inter-school competition. And one team found out where the questions were being hidden and stole them and won. And then it came out later. So the newspapers interviewed the members of the team. And they said, we have only one regret, that we got caught. That's what they said to the papers. You know, in our terms, I would say, these kids aren't married. What are they going to do for Shidduchim? You know, they're online in the paper that the only thing wrong was that they got caught. They said, everybody cheats, and the whole system is based on cheating, and if we can get ahead by stealing the questions, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I just
that would never happen in Great Britain. no one would be interviewed in the newspapers and saying online in Great Britain that yes, it's perfectly their right to cheat, just the only thing's wrong is getting caught. But in America, you have people who are brazen that way. We had a guy in Los Angeles 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, who was diagnosed positive with AIDS, and he went to a blood drive and donated blood. And when they caught him, they said, how can you give AIDS contaminated blood to a blood drive? He said, I'm going to die, so why do I care if other people die? You see, you're dealing with a different mental, a different attitude, a different set of social norms. I mean, you know, if one guy is publicized in the paper, there are 500,000 people who agree with him. Yeah.
Are your views on Sinem in this world that the temple being destroyed for a couple thousand years and our moral society that we're in, how does that fit in there?
Means causes hatred. Well, it is a terrible problem, and it's a problem which we still suffer from, and it's a problem which people try in various ways to correct. But I think that together with the Sinas Chinam, there's a considerable amount of Avas Chinam, causeless love. What does it mean for a person to have a stockpile of chairs and tables renting out free to strangers? That's not causeless love. I have no reason to like this person, no reason to serve this person, no reason to help this person, and it's open for anybody. I go down like that, I help them take it out to the car, take it back from the car, it's open and so on, and I do this year in and year out because I want to provide a service for other people. So I think that the causeless hatred from which we definitely suffer goes hand in hand with the causeless love that we practice. Remember, I didn't say that the society is perfect. What he says, on balance, the achievement is much higher than the achievement that my parents lived in Boston. And when they were nifter, when they died, one after the other, one within 6 months. So I came in from Eretz Yisrael. I have a brother who's living in Boston. Came to the burial. I left Boston as a resident in 1969. They died in 1992. A minion of people showed up each time at the field where we buried them so that I would have a minion there together with me. My brother was there. Not one of his friends showed up. Not one. It's the middle of the day. You're busy. Other things to do. What do you mean? I came over in the evening to, you know, visit him. And he turned to me and he said, he's not religious, and he turned to me and he said, I envy you this. That you have a community of people who care for one another. That's quite true. There's a famous story in New York of a fellow whose car broke down by the side of the road. He had a yarmulke on. So a from guy stopped, to help him. He was helping him. He looks at him and he says, are you Jewish? The guy says, actually, no, I'm Puerto Rican, but I learned that if you put on one of these caps, someone will help you. That's right. Put on one of those caps, someone will help you. If you don't, very unlikely. This is what the system achieves. So someone asks, can you be good? Do better next time. Can you be good without God? Tell them your actions. Many of them will be miserable if you don't take God into account. And as far as your character is concerned, your character will be greatly improved, though there will be weaknesses, and there can be people who are not religious who do have a good moral character, but proportionally it's going to be a tremendous difference, yeah.
What about myths that would be aside from the ownership would be considered immoral, the ones you say the way that reform people divide them up. When people do those purely out of fear of Hashem, you said that a good person is someone that does something for the right thing. If they're not doing it because it's a good thing and they're only doing it because they're afraid of the punishment, does that still make them a good person?
Okay, this is a very important point. They're doing the right action, and they're doing the right action because of a realistic motivation. A realistic motivation. There is reward and punishment. That realistic motivation includes recognition that there is a God who created the universe and is running the universe. That's not zero. But our sources say that that's the very lowest level of valid performance. It's a person who doesn't really appreciate the intrinsic morality of the actions and doesn't really appreciate the intrinsic moral relationship that he has to God. So it's valid, but it's valid on the very lowest level.
Taking away the bad, is that part of good? Or is that the
cyber? Sure, if a person's suffering from... if somebody's playing this saxophone and keeping up the whole block, if you plug a saxophone with bubblegum, you know, so the block can go to sleep, that's definitely a good thing to do. Yeah.
Okay, but a person doesn't have to constantly work on doing... you know, learning and mindset. I'm saying by him working on self-protection as well is also a good thing.
Yes, maybe I should say two little things here. There are people who say, well, if this guy keeps Shabbos and keeps kashrus and learns Torah and everything else, but he cheats on his taxes or doesn't give charity to other people, so then he's a phony. He's a phony because, you know, that's not what religion is all about. Let's say that's true. But if that's true, then it's equally true that a person who gives charity and helps people and is a good citizen is over the zone and doesn't keep Shabbos is also a phony. Because Shabbos is also what religion is about. It's one of the 10 pronouncements by the creator of the universe at Sinai. And that guy's also a phony. There's no reason to put the interpersonal commandments as the real stuff. That's the real content and all the rest is somehow secondary. There's nothing in God's way of organizing the mitzvos that indicates that the one category is better than the other category. The other thing I want to say is this. Some of you know this, and you'll certainly learn if you don't. There is a distinction made in Jewish literature which will sound like the one that I made, but it's really quite different. They divide mitzvos into those that are interpersonal and those that are just between man and God. That is a true distinction. Though it's a little misleading, because the interpersonal mitzvah is also between man and God. God is not absent from any mitzvah. There are two-part mitzvahs and three-part mitzvahs. A two-part mitzvah is tefillin. God said to man, put on tefillin. A three-part mitzvah is give charity, because God said to this person to give charity to that person. But God is in both of them. Neither of them is divorced from God. Both of them have the God moral content. Some of them have, in addition, an interpersonal moral content. But God is not absent from any of them.
Preventing yourself from doing bad is doing good.
What's that? Say again?
Preventing yourself from what they do in bad is doing good.
That's also true. That's also true. Yeah. That's okay. Think, maybe the word good here gives your remark its punch. Think of improvement. The word improvement is more neutral. That's true. So it's stopping to do bad things is definitely an improvement. Yeah.
First of all, going back to what we talked about in the differences in the creative community, wouldn't not pushing and especially not pushing an older person be a universal value versus a universal value?
I don't see why. I think to me it depends upon how people experience it. Let me tell you, when I became Frum, there was something that bothered me terrifically. It took me years to overcome by it, to say something. Meet a new person, especially a person that's a little older than you are, to take your hand and he'll hold it. He can hold it for 3 or 4 minutes. I found that very disturbing. Coming from the culture that I came from, I found it very uncomfortable. But that's the way they do it. And you say, it's right to hold the hand for exactly 3.5 seconds. So he holds it for 25 seconds, something wrong with that. It's ridiculous. It's a cultural norm. It's just a cultural norm. And the proof of it is, does anybody get upset in that culture when somebody else does it? If nobody gets upset, but you're not in the culture. You're not part of the culture. If you're part of the culture and nobody in the culture looks upset, everybody looks relaxed, everybody's friendly, so then I can't see why it's just not a different cultural norm.
In Nazi culture, no one got upset when people did. I mean, I don't want to compare with you, but I'm saying in a culture, something doesn't, if people don't get upset by doing that, doesn't necessarily make it right.
I understand. When the Nazi puts the Jew in a concentration camp, the Jew isn't upset?
No, the Nazis have been upset in that culture, just like, you
know. So what? Here I'm talking about everybody, the victim, the so-called victim. The person you look upon as a victim isn't bothered by it. So why do you call him a victim? But you're not part of that culture. You know, you walk in certain places and there are people who walk down the street with boom boxes. You heard of that? You heard of that, right? Now, frankly, I don't like their music, and I would enjoy the peace and quiet of the street. Can I say that they're viciously victimizing me? No, in their culture, to do that is perfectly acceptable. It's considered to be a kind of success. And so they're like, well, who am I to say that that's objectively wrong?
Interesting
observation. It is true. I think this is.
That's also because maybe they saw more. They were responding to me, who they thought I would fit more into their community.
Could very well.
If I was a Haredi or a secular, then maybe I'd get a different response.
I think that's right. And I think that when you say it to a secular, so he looks at you with a kippah on and he thinks, the guy's putting me down. The guy's putting me down. What? Okay, would you have a beard? You know, coming back with a guy. You know, he thinks he's putting me down. I have a friend. Moshe Meiselman, whom I quote from time to time. He has a son-in-law who's a Slonim Rafasi. And this son-in-law was in Heathrow Airport. He's an Israeli, the son-in-law. And a non-religious Israeli came up to him and said to him, you people think that we're not Jewish. So, Rabbi Meiselman's son-in-law said, no, I think you are Jewish. You think you're not Jewish. He says, come on, stop playing games. You know, we know what you think. You think we're not Jewish. So Rabbi Meiselman's son-in-law says, no, listen. You don't keep Shabbos, right? Of course I don't keep Shabbos. All right, I don't keep Shabbos. He says, does it bother you that you don't keep Shabbos? Of course not. It doesn't bother me that I don't keep Shabbos. Of course not. He says, yeah, that's because you don't think you're Jewish. But it bothers me that you don't keep Shabbos because I think you are Jewish. Now that's the attitude. And then some of them know that. Anyway, you can predict it, but over here it's a little different. Over here, everything is ideological. Everything is ideological. Can you imagine in America petitioning the court to block a sale of a house in your neighborhood on the grounds that the person is religious? You could never do that in the United States of America, but they do it here. That's what it's like. They're taking over traditionally secular neighborhoods. They're moving in and changing the culture. You build a synagogue or you build a school with zoning permission. They go to the high court and have it closed down. That happened in several cities in this country. You could never do that in America. You don't appreciate what's going on here. What's going on here is a struggle for the Jewish soul. Democracy means nothing. The high court means nothing. The police force means nothing. This is a struggle for the soul of the people. And each side will use whatever means it deems effective to make progress in this struggle. I'll tell you one more thing that I've got to go. There's a fellow named John Rawls, who was one of the great political philosophers of the 20th century, professor at Harvard. Thomas Nagel wrote a retrospective on his work. He's still alive, but he's ill, and apparently he's not doing any creative philosophical work anymore. Thomas Nagel also I have tremendous respect for as a non-Jewish philosopher. And he expressed one of Rawls' principles, which was an eye-opener for me, and I think it's very important to know. A liberal society, an open liberal society, is based on the premise that your highest values are the values that enable you to get along with people from different cultures, different belief systems, different religions. Everybody has values, and everybody has a hierarchy of values. If you're going to have a society, a multicultural society, then the members of that society have to have, at the top of their value priorities, the values that are necessary in order to have such a society built. If someone has values which don't lead to the construction of such a society, and he puts them higher, then the ability to construct such a society is impossible. That's what's wrong with the Western liberal attempt to convert the Muslim world politically, because they haven't got such a value structure. For them, the Quran and Islam is more important than the values of a multicultural society. And that's why they'll never agree to it. That's why they want Islamic republics. And some of them want Islamic law. Because the highest value is not the values of cooperation and tolerance and indifference towards religious values and cultural values and moral values, the kind of indifference that's required in order to overlook other people's actions. It's like in the abortion debate, there used to be a bumper sticker: if you don't like abortions, don't have one. Right? But the person who's against abortion says that it's murder. Would you have a bumper sticker that says, if you don't like murder, don't commit one? No. Because you understand that the opposition to murder is that it's immoral. But if you write, if you don't like abortions, don't have one, what you're saying is, abortion is free. Some people like it, some people don't. And put your tolerance of different views politically higher on your scale of values than your value of prohibiting murder. Now for some people, that's going to be nuts. Political tolerance is more important than my outrage against murder? No, thank you. Okay.